Today is Tuesday, July 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Protesters in Mali say they won't stop until President Keita resigns.
Our civil disobedience, this will continue. That's the order we have given from the beginning.
Plus, why is Washington taking a position on the South China Sea now?
My guess is that it has something to do with events in, say, the last 4 or 5 months.
And steps some are taking in Hong Kong not to violate its new national security law. We'll have those stories and more next. Witnesses said police in Mali's capital of Bamako fired into the air on Monday to disperse protesters calling for President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita to resign. This came hours after the United Nations condemned the use of lethal force against demonstrators. Three witnesses told Reuters News that several people were injured by falling bullets and tear gas canisters in the Badala Bugu neighborhood. The area is a center for the month-long protest movement denouncing Keita's failure to quash militant violence or address the disputed results of recent legislative elections. The government has declined requests for comment. Opposition and pro-democracy groups in Mali say their demand for Keita to resign remains unchanged, even as the president showed a gesture of goodwill on Monday by releasing jailed protesters. But as Dr. Ramada Sissoko Cisse, the president of Change in Mali Movement, told Daybreak Africa host James Buddy, the civil disobedience will continue until the president resigns.
The opposition leaders who have been arrested since a couple of days ago in very bad conditions, one of them said he was kept in the bathroom for 2 days. And we all understand that's abuse of human right there. They all have been released today, but some of them have been arrested. We don't know their whereabout right now. So we are waiting to hear from those people.
Dr. Cisse, does this mean now that the civil disobedience that has been going on would come to an end now?
Well, actually, we have said since from the beginning that regardless of how many people they will be arresting or who they arrest, our civil disobedience will be continuing until the president resigns. Now, we are waiting for his resignation. People who have been released, we have some people still kept in prisons in Mali. We don't know where they are, but our civil disobedience, this will continue. That's the order we have given from the beginning.
The United Nations and ECOWAS have both expressed concern about what they call violence on both sides, and they are calling for dialogue.
Well, the problem is that Malians who are demonstrating, have been demonstrating since 6 weeks ago, have never used any weapon, because we don't have it. These are peaceful demonstrators. So they are being attacked by the police department, and the police is denying that right now. There's a special department of the police called the FORSAT, and they're denying the fact that we say that there have been violence. I mean, there is violence, but they deny them their involvement in this violence. We're trying to even figure out who is doing that, because the police chief is not acknowledging that right now. So it must be some kind of other thing that we don't understand. So the peaceful demonstrators have nothing in their hands, so they cannot be violent. So there are some young people amongst them from the government trying to distract people from their goal, which is to peaceful demonstrate to ask the president to resign democratically by the voice of the people and peacefully. So at this point, we are just asking the international community to be able to convince the president that his time is over. The people of Mali do not trust him anymore. He has been killing people already. Killing has been done in the center of Mali by jihadists, but he's adding to the problem. He cannot solve the problem. He does not have the trust. People don't believe in him. And the only thing that can resolve this problem is for him to resign peacefully, for us to have a peaceful transition so that we can bring this country back to a normal situation again.
Dr. Ramada Sissoko Cisse is the president of the Change in Mali movement, and she was speaking with Daybreak Africa's James Buddy from Lawrenceville, Georgia. The ex-chief of Timbuktu's Islamic Police went on trial Tuesday in The Hague for a number of alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity. The charges include rape, sexual slavery, and destroying irreplaceable shrines in the ancient Malayan city. Lisa Bryant has that story.
Chef numéro 9, esclavage sexuel. wearing a flowing blue gown and white headdress and a face mask pushed below his nose. Al-Hassan Ag Abdulaziz Ag Mohammed Ag Mahmoud replied yes to whether he understood each of the 13 charges against him. But on each count, he refused to plead either innocent or guilty. International Criminal Court prosecutors accuse Al-Hassan of rape, torture, and sexual slavery, among other atrocities allegedly committed between 2012 and 2013 as Timbuktu's police chief after jihadists occupied the city.
Aujourd'hui commence le procès tant attendu.
Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda described as unimaginable the crimes committed by jihadists in the city. Under Al-Hassan, she said, the Islamic police belittled, humiliated, and persecuted residents on religious grounds. Prosecutors argue Al-Hassan abused, whipped, and tortured Timbuktu residents who violated strict religious laws. He allegedly forced young women and girls to marry jihadist fighters, which the prosecution claims led to rape and sexual enslavement. And he is accused of participating in lashings of men and women and of playing a role in the destruction of local shrines. Al-Hassan's defense argues he is not mentally fit to stand trial.
How can somebody who is experiencing such post-traumatic stress that they are dissociating in a way that they avoid memories, properly assist counsel in analyzing the evidence that to date it still has not had the opportunity to even investigate, in order to prepare an adequate defense?
ICC judges ruled Al-Hassan to be medically examined, but ruled the opening would not be delayed. Al-Hassan is the second Islamist to face trial at the ICC over the destruction of Timbuktu's religious and historical buildings. In 2016, Ahmed El-Faqi Al-Mahdi pled guilty to attacks on the UNESCO World Heritage Site. He was sentenced to 9 years in prison. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
The United States on Monday said China's claims to offshore resources across most of the South China Sea are completely unlawful. This is what it calls Beijing's campaign to bully to control them. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said, quote, Beijing has offered no coherent legal basis for its nine-dash line claim in the South China Sea since formally announcing it in 2009. China vies with Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, Vietnam, Indonesia, and the Philippines over parts of the 3.5 million square kilometer South China Sea. The Hague-based Permanent Court of Arbitration, in a binding decision issued in 2016, rejected China's maritime claims as having no basis in international law. China dismissed the ruling. Grant Newsham is a senior research fellow with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, and I spoke to him via Skype about the timing of Washington's statement.
So, but why the Trump administration has finally sort of said enough is an interesting question. And my guess is that it has something to do with events in probably say the last 4 or 5 months, where Chinese aggression and pushing has really gotten to the point all along its borders, from Japan to the Philippines, down to Malaysia, Indonesia, over to India, that I think it has reached a point where the administration said, you know, I would say we have nothing to lose, but the time is now. China may have rolled the dice and see how much they can get and may be ready. And who knows, maybe there's something haven't heard, but that, you know, they are perhaps willing to take their shot, say, against Taiwan, maybe one of the offshore islands or in the East China Sea, the Senkakus with Japan. But I think it was Chinese behavior that has provoked this. And somehow the cumulative effect of what they've been doing, but I think the specifics of what they have, what has happened since the virus outbreak, I think that is alarming enough to cause the administration to do something no other administration has done and basically say, we side with everybody else and not with China.
Is it too little too late? Because when you look at the events that have taken place in the South China Sea, with Beijing's reclamation projects on different shoals to build bases essentially out of nothing. They're entrenched there. So what does a statement like this have in terms of quantifiable potential?
Well, that's what we're going to find out. And that is the key question. I think it's what everybody wants to know, particularly the other countries in the region, because as you note, it's late in the day, and that China has been allowed to really insinuate itself and into the South China Sea physically and has a pretty strong military presence and the ability to almost exercise de facto military control as things stand. So what you have is the Americans have now said enough. You know, we're not going to allow this we're not going to accept this behavior. And now the question is, you can imagine the Chinese saying, well, you know, I'm sure they're apoplectic as it is, but you can almost hear them saying, like some guy from Brooklyn, well, what are you going to do about it? And that's the question, is what are the Americans going to do and what can they do? They are going to have to, you know, beef up their military. Because currently the U.S. Navy just doesn't have enough ships. The Air Force needs more aircraft. So they are going to have to do that. You know, this isn't going to be done on the cheap.
I wanted to ask you about ASEAN. You know, ASEAN has been trying to hammer out a definitive code of conduct with China for the South China Sea for a number of years. Where do you see things going with that body as a whole, with the claimants interacting with China?
The ASEAN nations know that they're being trifled with by the Chinese. You know, this code of conduct has been almost 20 years in the making now. And some of the Chinese demands have been absolutely outrageous. But ASEAN, I think, as I noted, they want an option. If you can give, you know, if there's somebody that they can turn to or align with that can help fend off Chinese pressure and domination, I think they'll be receptive to that, but they're going to, as they always are, I think they are going to be careful and quiet about how they do it. But, you know, I think that is where you can make some, the Americans can make some advances, but also, say, bolster their own position, because the more friends you have, even if they're quietly cooperating, the better.
That was Grant Newsham, Senior Research Fellow with the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has ordered that Huawei telecommunications equipment be purged completely from Britain's 5G network by 2027. The move risks the ire of China by signaling that the world's biggest telecoms equipment maker is no longer welcome in the West. The United States had long pushed Johnson to reverse a decision he made in January to grant Huawei a limited role in 5G. London has also been dismayed by a crackdown in Hong Kong and the perception China did not tell the whole truth over the coronavirus. And still to come in today's program:
there will be no return to the old normal for the foreseeable future, but there is a roadmap to a situation where we can control the disease and get on with our lives.
This is VOA News.
In a minute.
Supernovas and gamma ray bursts have been considered by scientists to be the brightest explosions in the universe. Astronomers have found evidence that points to a new class of cosmic explosions called fast blue optical transients. The first was discovered in June 2018 when astronomers from around the world observed a flash of light they never saw before in the night sky. Studying observational data, two different teams of scientists have recently found two more explosions with similar characteristics of the first. One took place in 2016 and the other in 2018. The astronomers noticed that while blue optical transients had some of the same features of supernova explosions and gamma ray bursts, they also have their own unique traits. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Hong Kong's new national security law punishes secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison. It allows mainland Chinese security agents to also operate officially in Hong Kong for the first time. In the past 2 weeks, Hong Kong publisher Raymond Young has hastily made changes to a draft paper copy of a book so as not to run afoul of the new law. Reuters' Libby Hogan takes things from here.
Blue sticky notes mark where Raymond Young is reshaping a book called To Freedom. Young's a Hong Kong publisher, and he spent the last 2 weeks choosing which words and phrases to yank out of this collection of essays. Their authors were participants in the pro-democracy protests that shook this Chinese-ruled city last year. Red lines have struck out the word revolution, any phrases calling for Hong Kong's independence, and a slogan that's been banned. Hong Kong's once unbridled and prolific independent publishers are now censoring themselves in the face of China's new national security law for the city. The law makes the broadly defined crimes of secession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces punishable by up to life in prison. Young says revising the book has been a painful process.
This is really about something that is affecting national security, like Hong Kong independence. The only way out, then we feel that this would be too dangerous, so we simply remove this whole part.
Young says after Beijing first introduced the law, the original printer bailed and two other printers turned it away. Another has agreed to take it anonymously, but wants to get a better sense of how the law is implemented first. It comes as organisers of the annual Hong Kong Book Fair, now postponed over the global health crisis, told exhibitors not to display what it called unlawful books without explaining further. Veteran publisher Jimmy Pang has taken part in the fair every year. He believes a book by political cartoonist Zun Si with unflattering caricatures of Chinese leaders could be deemed too sensitive, even though it was published before the law came into effect.
Immediately after the legislation of the national security law, there are situations including many publishing houses or writers having to stop writing or publishing finished books, and there is no printing house willing to print them. Even if there is a printing house that would help them print, there might not be a distributor to help them distribute it. Even if there is a distributor, there might be no bookstore willing to put the books on their shelves.
Hong Kong authorities say freedom of speech remains intact. But in the past 2 weeks, shops have removed protest-related decorations and slogans. And public libraries have taken some books off the shelves.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. With the number of confirmed coronavirus infections around the world topping 13 million, including more than 570,000 deaths, the United States says it expects to start producing potential vaccine doses by the end of the summer. The news comes as more and more governments are imposing or reimposing strict quarantine and physical distancing guidelines to blunt the spread of the disease. World Health Organization Director General Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said there was no going back to the old normal for the foreseeable future, but did outline three things society should be working toward.
First, a focus on reducing mortality and suppressing transmission. Second, an empowered, engaged community that takes individual behavior measures in the interest of each other. And third, we need strong government leadership and coordination of comprehensive strategies.
VOA has expanded pandemic coverage on our website. 100 meters beneath the borders of France and Switzerland, near the city of Geneva, there's a tunnel 27 kilometers around called the Large Hadron Collider. This is where scientists are working to answer one of life's biggest riddles. What is the universe made out of? The physicists working at CERN, officially the European Organization for Nuclear Research, are looking for things like antimatter and dark matter and how the universe works. Penny Dixon reports from Geneva.
100 meters beneath the borders of France and Switzerland, near the city of Geneva, is a tunnel 27 kilometers around called the Large Hadron Collider, where scientists are working to answer one of life's biggest riddles. What is the universe made of? The physicists working at CERN, officially the European Organization for Nuclear Research, are looking for elements like antimatter and dark matter, and how the universe works. VOA's Penny Dixon traveled to CERN and files this report. Inside the tunnel, a gigantic machine is helping scientists decipher what science has never been able to explain. the origins of the universe. But just because they've been able to use the machine to confirm the existence of the smallest particles that theoretical physicists have predicted, and can accelerate protons, one of the building blocks of atoms, to nearly the speed of light, and create antimatter, it doesn't mean they understand everything yet. Ludovan Sird is a physicist with CERN's CMS collaboration facility. Sird says, at what is thought to have been the beginning of the universe, the so-called Big Bang, scientists believe that matter, like you and me, along with antimatter, negative matter, were created in equal amounts.
In principle, if the difference between the two is only the charge, they should have just recombined and leave nothing but radiation. However, we're here. I'm talking with you right now. So it means that at some point, matter took over the antimatter, and this must be because there are some differences between matter and antimatter that we don't know about.
Searching for those differences is one of the tasks for the people at CMS, the compact muon solenoid, one of four main research points along the Large Hadron Collider at CERN. Packets of protons race around a ring in beams, traveling clockwise and counterclockwise. When the physicists are ready, the beams are focused by a team led by Rende Steerenberg and made to collide at one of four experiment locations around the circle.
And then on either end of the experiments, we will switch on focusing magnets so that the beam squeezes into a small dimension, and therefore the probability of collision increases.
Out of the 200 billion protons in the two beams rushing around the circuit, only 100 will collide. But right now, the collider and the experiments around it are in the midst of a two-year shutdown for maintenance and upgrades, which happens every 3 years. For VOA, it meant a rare glimpse into a world not many get to see. For physicists like Patricia McBride with the Fermi Lab in the United States, the shutdown provides an opportunity to recharge.
But we're looking at ways of making the detector better, repairing things, putting in new detectors, and preparing for the future runs, which the experiment will be running until, we hope, till 2035.
The CMS collaboration includes some 4,000 scientists from more than 50 countries from across Europe, as well as India, China, South Korea, Egypt, other parts of the Middle East, and Russia. The discoveries and developments made at CERN are already helping to transform fields as diverse as nuclear waste disposal, medical testing, detection of art forgeries, and efforts to disrupt financial markets. Penny Dixon, VOA News, Geneva.
You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Malawi, at long last, has a newly sworn-in president following a 13-month election process. On June 23rd, opposition leader Lazarus Chakwera won the country's rerun presidential vote, defeating incumbent president Peter Mutharika with more than 58% of the vote. The first presidential election was held back in May 2019, when President Mutharika claimed a narrow victory. But Mr. Chakwera, who came in second place, alleged voter fraud and appealed to Malawi's constitutional court. The court found evidence of widespread irregularities and in February 2020 ordered a new election to be held. Malawi is only the second African nation to annul a presidential election over irregularities, following Kenya in 2017. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed admiration for the commitment to the rule of law and democracy exhibited during Malawi's presidential elections.
The people of Malawi elected Lazarus Chakwera as their next president. This is only the second time in Africa that a court has overturned a presidential election tainted by irregularities, and the only time that a re-election process has resulted in an election of an opposite party candidate. Truly a historic opportunity for the people of that country.
President Chakwera has called the election a win for democracy and justice. In his inaugural address, he promised not to put himself above the rule of law. This means that as required by law, I will make a full declaration of my assets each year. I will go to Parliament to be questioned by the people about my handling of state affairs. I will propose legislation to reduce the powers of the presidency and empower institutions to operate independently, including Parliament and the Anti-Corruption Bureau. This is an historic opportunity for Malawi to work toward a future of greater prosperity, government accountability, and freedom.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.